If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
All right, Matt. So a pirate walks into a bar, and he's wearing this hat made out of paper towels. And the bartender goes, "Dude, what's with the paper towel hat?" He goes, "Arr, there's a bounty on me head."
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales.
All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm hot.
Yeah.
It's hot up here. It's been hot all day. I'm sweating in places I didn't know had sweat glands. It's brutal.
Yeah, I'm still working on a sponsorship from the company I use that is a powder that goes on liquid and turns to a powder for the nether regions.
I've got some of that too.
Yeah, I use it every day here in the Texas heat. And
you have to.
Maybe. I'm not saying the name of it because I'm still hoping for a sponsorship out of them. But before we get off on summer sweating in places that we shouldn't sweat, we'll say go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales, sign up to become a patron. You can also do that little QR code that's above my head there, and it'll take you right to our Patreon. You can sign up for one of three levels, a 1, 5, or 10. Every level gets a bonus episode every week. It's like a short version of a Graveyard Tales episode.
Mm-hmm.
Best way that we can describe it. Then if you move up to the $5 or $10, you get that. Plus, you get the ad-free audio and video versions of the episode. So you can listen ad-free. No pre-roll, post-roll ads. No host-read ads. It's ad-free. Then if you move up to $10, you get all of that, plus you get our second show, Side Quest, which is a free-for-all. Who knows what we're going to talk about.
That's right. We got a cool one tonight, too.
Yeah. Sometimes I tell Matt survival stories. Sometimes Matt brings trivia games. I've brought Matt trivia games here recently just to pay him back. He brought me a thing that fit into one of my fears just to get me back. So lovely. But if you want to hear me and Matt in a different context, that would be the place to do it.
Yep.
Also, go check out our sponsors. If we have a sponsor for the show, the link will be in the show notes. You can find the link and the discount code there. Get you something from that sponsor at a discount. And we haven't said this before, but Matt has started us a TikTok.
Yep.
So if you tick or talk, go over there to TikTok.
Check it out.
And check it out. Just search Graveyard Tales. You'll find us. He does videos telling you about upcoming shows, and I'm sure it will grow from there. But he just started it. So go give us a follow on TikTok and share it if you have not. So on that note, Matt, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
You know, one of the things I love most about doing this show is finding stories that most people have never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody knows Bigfoot. Everybody knows Mothman. But every once in a while, you stumble across a creature that is so strange so oddly specific that you can't help but wonder where the story came from.
Yep.
And tonight's cryptid is exactly that. Because imagine you're driving through the forests of Washington State and your truck suddenly dies. Every electrical system goes silent. And you get out to go see what's wrong, and 30 feet away stands something that shouldn't exist. It's nearly 9 feet tall. It's covered in blue fur, and it has glowing yellow eyes. And folded behind its back are enormous bat-like wings. Now, that sounds like somebody took Bigfoot, Batman, and a gargoyle and mashed them up together.
Basically.
But that is exactly why this story has fascinated people for over 30 years. Tonight, we're going to talk about one of the Pacific Northwest's strangest cryptids, the Bat Squatch.
I remember when I first heard about the Bat Squatch, I thought that either somebody just misunderstood something.
Right.
You know, they just started saying words that didn't go together, or that they had done some illicit substance that they shouldn't be doing and witnessed something, but
that it was code for something else.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Exactly.
What do you think about Bat Squatch?
You seen that Bat Squatch?
I don't know. Maybe I like it. Maybe I don't. Yeah, what is
I'm not
it?
Hip to that. I don't know. I'm not cool. I don't know. But as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found the information. Everything we talk about is sourced and referenced in the sources in the bottom of our show notes. So there are places in this world where nature commands respect. We've talked about a few of them. Places where the landscape itself feels alive. Mountains that seem to breathe. Forests so dense that they swallow sound. Rivers that carved through stone for thousands of years, leaving behind stories almost as old as the earth itself. Well, the Pacific Northwest is filled with places like that. It's a land of towering evergreens, gray skies, heavy rain, and fog drifting between ancient cedars and Douglas firs. Even on a bright summer afternoon, there are valleys where sunlight barely reaches the forest floor. Just imagine that, Matt. It's crazy.
I know.
So it's no surprise that this region has become one of the richest sources of folklore in North America. Stories of giant hairy creatures roaming the wilderness, strange lights dancing over lakes, phantom canoes gliding across tailwaters, and spirits inhabiting the forest, thunderbirds whose wings shake the heavens. All stuff that we've explored before. We talked about Ape Canyon and the Sasquatch legends surrounding Mount St. Helens. Well, those tales have been woven into this landscape for generations. But, like Matt said, tonight we're going to tell you a different story. Because one of the greatest natural disasters in American history, after the mountain exploded, people began reporting something entirely new. It wasn't an ape, wasn't a bear, wasn't a giant bird, but it was massive and had leathery wings. But the weirdest thing, Matt, to me, was that it seemed to rise from the destruction itself.
Yeah, right. It was just so, I mean, it was, it didn't exist prior.
Right.
Then after the eruption, here it is.
Yeah. It's so weird.
So there's got to be a correlation there.
I agree. I don't know. I have crazy Adam theories I'll give you toward the end. The ones that make no sense even to me, but I like to say them. Now, whether the Bat Squatch is an undiscovered creature, a product of frightened imaginations, or just another chapter in the Pacific Northwest's long history of strange encounters, to understand the legend, we first have to understand the mountain. So long before it appeared on postcards, long before scientists climbed its slopes and before roads wound through the surrounding forest, the people who lived here already knew the mountain. To them, it was not simply another peak in the Cascade Range. It was a living presence. Today, we know it as Mount St. Helens, but that name is relatively new. For thousands of years, indigenous people throughout the Pacific Northwest had their own names for the volcano. The Cowlitz called it La Huetla'a, often transcribed as the smoker. I apologize for my pronunciation of that, but if you are a Graveyard Tales listener, me screwing up pronunciations is nothing new to you.
Right.
But the Klickitat people had similar names referring to smoke and fire in descriptions of the mountain. Now, these communities had watched the mountain for generations. Their oral tradition preserved memories of a landscape that could change dramatically and sometimes violently. One of the best-known traditions tells of a great love triangle among the mountains. According to the story, the Great Spirit transformed three figures into mountains. Mount Hood became the proud chief Weist, Mount Adams became Pato, and between them stood the beautiful maiden Luwit. Now, when two warriors fought over her, the earth shook. Fire burst from the ground, forests burned, and rivers overflowed. To end the destruction, the Great Spirit turned all three into mountains forever, and Luwit became Mount St. Helens. So, it's a cool story, but it is also fascinating because it may preserve distant memories of volcanic activity long before written history in that region. The people who first called this land home didn't need geology textbooks to understand that mountains could be dangerous. They watched them breathe.
Yeah.
And if a tribe that has lived there for thousands of years tells you something about a mountain, believe it.
Right.
So Mount St. Helens began forming roughly 40,000 years ago. It's geologically young compared with many surrounding Cascade volcanoes, but it was built by one of the most powerful forces on Earth. Off the western coast of North America, the Juan de Fuca plate slowly dives beneath the much larger North American plate. As it sinks into the Earth's mantle, the heat melts rock into magma, and that magma searches for weaknesses and rises toward the surface, sometimes quietly, sometimes very violently. Well, over tens of thousands of years, repeated eruptions built Mount St. Helens layer by layer. Lava hardened into rock, ash settled, new eruptions covered old ones. The result was a stratovolcano, a towering cone made from alternating layers of lava, ash, and volcanic debris. Now, these volcanoes can be extraordinarily explosive because thick magma traps tremendous pressure. And when that pressure is finally released, the results can be catastrophic. Well, when Europeans arrived in the Pacific Northwest, they were struck by the mountain's beauty. In 1792, a British naval officer, George Vancouver, sailed along the Pacific coast while mapping the region. The volcano was named for Eileen Fitzherbert, the first Baron St. Helens, a British diplomat who never actually saw the mountain. How would you like to have a mountain named after you and not even get to see it?
Well, that would not be fun.
Right?
You know, if you're going to name a mountain after me, then by God, I'm going to live there.
Right?
I'm going to the top of it.
Yep. Matt is going to live on Mount Matt.
Yeah, that's right. So,
now, throughout the 19th century, fur trappers, traders, missionaries, and settlers wrote about the nearly 10,000-foot snow-covered peak. Its smooth, almost perfect cone was compared with Mount Fuji, and some called it the most beautiful mountain in America. Well, by the middle of the 20th century, Mount St. Helens had become one of Washington's most popular outdoor destinations. People fished the rivers, camped under the evergreens, hiked the trails, hunted elk, and spent weekends around Spirit Lake. To visitors, the mountain seemed peaceful, permanent, and timeless. But geologists kind of had a different thought about it. The Cascade Range is not simply a collection of beautiful mountains. It's an active volcanic region, and Mount St. Helens had erupted many times during the previous 4,000 years. Historical records described ash clouds, steam, and occasional explosions during the early 19th century. Well, then the mountain went quiet. Decade after decade passed, trees reclaimed old lava flows, wildlife returned, new generations came to believe the volcano was asleep, and eventually most people stopped thinking about it altogether. By the 1970s, Spirit Lake was surrounded by cabins, lodges, campgrounds, and logging operations. Every summer, thousands of campers, fishermen, and hikers entered the forest. Children played in the waters, boats drifted across the lakes. So everything was peaceful and everybody thought it was permanent. Very few people imagined they were vacationing beside a ticking geological clock. One man would become almost as famous as the mountain itself, though. His name was Harry R. Truman. Now, absolutely no relation to the president, but Harry owned the Mount St. Helens Lodge on the shore of Spirit Lake. He was a gruff, opinionated, and stubborn man beyond belief. He had lived beside the mountain for decades, and he knew the trails, the shoreline, and the visitors who passed through his lodge. To Harry Truman, the mountain was simply part of the scenery. He had seen it every day for years, and he was not afraid of it. That confidence would make him one of the most recognizable faces of the coming disaster. For nearly 123 years, Mount St. Helens had remained quiet enough that many people forgot it was a volcano at all. But deep beneath the mountain, molten rock was rising. Soon, earthquakes would shake the ground. The summit would begin to deform, and scientists would realize they were witnessing the awakening of one of the most dangerous volcanoes in North America. So, let's, Matt, talk about the eruption in more detail than we did on our Ape Canyon episode. Because we mentioned it, but it didn't play as vital a role to Ape Canyon as it does to old Bat Squatch here. Now, on March 20th, 1980, and I know I wasn't alive yet, but Matt was.
I was.
Yeah. March 20th, 1980, a magnitude 4.2 earthquake struck beneath Mount St. Helens. By itself, it was not really that alarming, but the shaking didn't stop. Over the next several days, hundreds of earthquakes rattled the mountain, then thousands of earthquakes. Scientists from the United States Geological Survey rushed to the area and installed seismographs and monitoring equipment. The tremors were not random. Magma was forcing its way upward through solid rock, cracking and breaking everything in its path. The mountain was waking up. On March 27th, exactly 1 week after the first significant earthquake, an explosion blasted a crater into the summit. Ash rose nearly 7,000 feet into the sky, and steam billowed above the peak. For the first time in more than a century, Mount St. Helens had erupted. The eruption was relatively small, but it erased any doubt. This was not a false alarm. The volcano was active. Scientists and government officials immediately faced the question everyone was asking. How bad was this going to get? And the honest answer was that no one really knew. Volcanology was still a relatively young science. Researchers understood why volcanoes erupted, but predicting exactly when and how remained incredibly difficult. So new explosions followed. Some lasted only minutes. Others sent ash drifting across eastern Washington. Scientists monitored the mountain from nearby ridges and from helicopters while reporters from across the country descended on the area. How would you like that job, Matt? You're having to fly near an active volcano in a helicopter.
Right. It reminds me of that movie Dante's Peak.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, yeah, I would, if somebody came to town and said, hey, this mountain's going to explode anytime, I'd be like, I'm out. Yeah, I mean, they'd be like, where'd that guy go? He's down the road, man.
Yeah. He's not sticking around or boarding a helicopter.
No, I don't want to look down in it. I don't want to ride up on it. I don't, nope. Get me away from here.
Yep. As far as you think is safe, and then go a little further. Now, the investigators noticed something that stunned even experienced volcanologists. The north side of the mountain was growing, not upward, but outward. A giant bulge had formed on the volcano's northern flank. In some places, the mountainside was pushing outward by as much as 5 feet per day.
God, man.
and people still stuck around. What? I don't understand. If a mountain starts looking like it's breathing in and taking a big breath, I'm leaving because I know what goes in has got to come out.
Right.
Now, imagine standing beside a mountain and knowing that an entire hillside is moving toward you. Inside the volcano, magma was not rising directly toward the summit. It was forcing its way into the north side, inflating the mountain like a balloon. Every measurement told the same story. Pressure was increasing, and the mountain was deforming before their eyes. USGS geologist David Johnston and his colleagues carefully documented the bulge. That's a weird statement.
Yes, you can take that out of context.
Very much so. Clip that one. Now, they knew it represented immense danger, but they could not say what form that danger would take. Would lava start flowing? Would the summit collapse? Would there be another ash eruption? No one had observed anything like this, so they didn't know. Officials established restricted zones around Mount St. Helens. Roadblocks appeared. National Guard troops assisted at checkpoints. Residents and cabin owners were ordered to leave. Most did. Some protested. Others simply could not believe the danger was real. The mountain had already produced several small eruptions, yet life continued. Businesses wanted to reopen. Cabin owners wanted to retrieve their belongings. Loggers wanted to get back to work. Officials were caught between public safety and growing frustration. Some people believed the scientists were overreacting. Others feared they were not reacting enough. That would be me.
Get right.
Not reacting enough. Now, then there was this guy that I mentioned, Harry Truman. By now, Harry had become a folk hero. Television crews loved him. Reporters couldn't get enough of his personality. And at 83 years old, he had no intention of abandoning the lodge that he had built or the mountain that he lived beside for decades. When asked about the evacuation order, he reportedly said, quote, "I don't have any idea whether it'll blow, but I don't believe to the point that I'm going to pack up." So, Harry's staying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again and again, reporters asked whether he was afraid. Again and again, Harry refused to leave. He joked with visitors, cared for his 16 cats, and insisted that the mountain knew him. Some people admired his determination. Others believed that he was making a terrible mistake. Even scientists pleaded with him to leave, but Harry politely declined. As spring wore on, Harry Truman became inseparable from Mount St. Helens in the public imagination. One represented the unstoppable force of nature. The other represented an equally immovable human spirit. Only one of them would survive what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
Through April and early May, thousands of earthquakes shook the volcano. Steam explosions continued. Ash vented into the atmosphere. The giant bulge just kept growing.
Ugh.
And people still stuck around.
I know. Anyway, it's crazy.
I'm sorry, but if anything like that were to happen here in Texas, as much as I love Texas, I'm going several states away.
You know,
until it clears out and then I'll come back.
But I can 100% appreciate people not wanting to abandon their homes.
Mm-hmm.
But,
absolutely.
I mean, it's not worth your life.
No.
I mean, worst case scenario, you move away. You go somewhere and stay for a little while. Nothing happens, and then you get the all clear, and you come back home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's if you leave, that's the worst thing, or you know, that would be the best scenario.
The best worst scenario.
Nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, but if it does, even a little bit, I'm like, you're putting your life at risk just by staying at home.
Yep. How many people have we heard that either didn't get a warning in time and somehow survived, and they're like, man, I wish we'd have gotten a warning.
Mm-hmm.
Or people that survived somehow and said, you know, I wished I'd have taken them up on the evacuation thing because this wasn't worth it.
Yeah, I mean, we see it every year. Hurricanes, mm-hmm. tornadoes, all kinds of yep. stuff. It happens.
Yep.
You know, you've got to be vigilant.
Vigilant. I like
vigilant.
It.
And, I mean, you know, when that many people tell you, hey, you need mm-hmm. to get out of here. And not only that, it wasn't like, I mean, when you go back now and you look at old clips about Mount St. Helens and they show Harry Truman, it really makes you feel for him and yep. and understand this old guy doesn't want to leave his home. You know, I wouldn't either, all this stuff. But they it gives you this idea sometimes that this just happened.
Mm-hmm.
That one day everything was fine. The next day everything's on fire. And Adam is telling you now that is not what happened.
Months.
The mountain was telling them for months, mm-hmm. I am pissed.
Yep.
Something yep. big is coming. I mean, when it's shooting out ash and steam and the side of it is growing, you've yep. got to go, that isn't right.
Yep.
You know?
when its bulge is growing, take notice.
That's right.
That's
words to live by.
Words to live by. Now, David Johnston, who I mentioned before, stationed at an observatory post that was several miles from the mountain, he tracked every change. His work would become invaluable to volcanology, but like everyone else, he could only watch. And nature and the mountain had to decide the rest. Well, beyond the exclusion zone, life settled into an uneasy routine. Hotels filled with reporters, helicopters buzzed overhead, residents watched the evening news for updates, and tourists parked along highways hoping to see another eruption. Smart. After nearly 2 months, the danger began to feel strangely familiar. People joked that the mountain had burped again. Well, it became easy to believe that the smaller explosions were the main event, or that the volcano was slowly relieving its pressure. In reality, every explosion was only a symptom. The real danger remained hidden inside the mountain. On the evening of May 17th, 1980, Mount St. Helens appeared unusually quiet, the calm before the storm. There was no dramatic ash plume, no spectacular explosion. Seismic instruments continued recording earthquakes, but nothing revealed what would happen only hours later. Scientists remained at their observation post. Emergency officials stayed alert. Most people went to bed expecting another day of uncertainty. Few people realized they were about to witness one of the most destructive volcanic eruptions in American history. The following morning, Sunday, May 18th, dawned clear and calm. The sky was blue, the forest was still, Spirit Lake reflected the mountain like glass. At 8:32 a.m., everything changed. The first thing was not an explosion, ash, or lava. It was an earthquake. In less than a minute, an entire mountainside collapsed in the largest landslide ever recorded. Moments later, a lateral blast traveling at hundreds of miles per hour flattened forest, erased lake shores, and forever reshaped the Pacific Northwest. When the ash finally settled, people would begin telling stories of strange things moving through a landscape unlike anything they had ever seen. When the eruption ended, Mount St. Helens no longer looked like the mountain that everybody remembered. The elegant, snow-covered cone that had dominated postcards and travel brochures was gone. Nearly 1,300 feet of the summit had just disappeared. Entire ridgelines had been erased. Spirit Lake had become a floating graveyard of shattered timber, and millions of trees lay scattered like matchsticks across the land. The blast flattened nearly 230 square miles of forest.
Golly!
Yep. Trees were stripped of branches, snapped in half, or driven into the ground like wooden spears. What had been one of the luscious forests in North America now looked like the surface of another planet. Gray, silent, and lifeless. For weeks, ash drifted through the air and the smell of sulfur lingered. Steam rose from vents across the devastated landscape, and the mountain continued erupting on and off for years. Did you know that, Matt?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it happened before I was born, but I know about the blast. I just didn't know all of this stuff leading up to it and the fact that it continued to erupt for several years. Now, at first, scientists were not sure anything could survive because entire hillsides had been scorched. Animals caught in the direct path of it vanished. Elk, black bears, cougars, thousands of birds, and millions of fish were just gone. Biologists feared the area might remain barren for decades, even centuries maybe. Instead, nature surprised everyone. Within months, green shoots pushed through the ash, seeds buried beneath the surface had survived. Plants returned from underground roots or arrived on the wind, and small mammals emerged from burrows that had protected them from the blast. Even some amphibians endured. Imagine you're that little rodent and you're in your hole, and then the next day you're having to dig through feet of ash to get out of your hole going, yeah. What happened?
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Haley Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium. It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Try it now for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Over time, life returned to Spirit Lake as well. The ecosystem rebuilt itself far faster than many expected, and Mount St. Helens became one of the greatest natural laboratories in the world. Researchers came from around the globe to study ecological recovery in real time, and every year brought another surprise. The mountain wasn't dead, it was healing. But while scientists studied plants, animals, and the changing landscape, other people were looking for something else. The eruption had created a wilderness unlike anything America had seen in modern times. Entire valleys became inaccessible, logging roads vanished beneath debris, forests familiar to hunters and hikers were rearranged beyond recognition. Some areas remained closed for years, others were simply too dangerous to enter. And whenever large portions of wilderness become inaccessible, stories begin. Well, hunters talked, loggers talked, helicopter pilots talked. Search and rescue workers shared strange experiences. Some reports had understandable explanations. The blast had changed the terrain so dramatically that familiar echoes behaved differently. Wind moving across broken ridges produced eerie whistles and low moans that hadn't been there before. Steam vents hissed from fractured earth. Wildlife had been displaced across an enormous area. But not every story was so easily explained. Today, millions of people visit Mount St. Helens to hike, photograph the volcano, learn about geology, and witness how nature rebuilt itself after the crazy destruction. Most leave having experienced one of America's greatest stories of destruction and recovery, but sometimes they leave with another story.
Now, before we get into the sightings, there's something interesting about this creature. Unlike Bigfoot, which has thousands of reports stretching back for centuries, unlike Mothman, which had dozens of witnesses over a relatively short period, the Bat Squatch has remarkably few sightings. In fact, there are really only a handful that anyone considers significant. Now, depending on what side of the fence you sit on, that's either a weakness or it's exactly what makes this story so intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if people were making this thing up, why aren't there hundreds of reports?
Right.
Why don't we hear about Bat Squatch every hunting season? Why isn't every hiker in Washington claiming they saw one? Instead, you have one very detailed account, a few scattered reports, and a mystery that's really never gone away. The creature itself is surprisingly consistent across these reports. Witnesses generally describe something standing between 8 and 9 feet tall. Its body is covered with bluish or bluish-gray fur.
Crazy.
Its head is often described as looking somewhere between a wolf, a dog, and a primate. Okay. It has pointed ears, bright yellow eyes, large white teeth, massive clawed feet, and of course, huge leathery bat wings.
I think I dated her in high school.
It's the bat wings, right? That's where it goes.
The clawed feet,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Now, these wings aren't like bird wings. They're not feathered. I mean, actual bat wings that stretch 20 feet or even more, according to some witnesses. If that's accurate, and that is a huge if here.
Yeah.
This would be one of the largest flying creatures ever reported anywhere in North America.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to the beginning. Everything really begins on April 16th, 1994. The witness was an 18-year-old named Brian Canfield. Now, one thing I appreciate about this story is that Brian wasn't hiking through the woods looking for monsters. He wasn't on a ghost hunt. He wasn't filming a documentary. He was just driving. And his route took him near Lake Kapausen in Washington. Now, Brian recalls that the morning was quiet, nothing really unusual, until his truck just suddenly quit. The engine died. The electrical system quit working. And according to Brian, everything just went dead. Now, if you've listened to enough paranormal stories, that detail probably caught your attention immediately, because electrical interference has shown up in UFO encounters and in ghost stories and in Bigfoot reports. Even some Mothman accounts talk about electrical failure.
Yeah.
Does that mean that what Brian experienced was paranormal? No, not at all. Vehicles break down every day. But it's still an interesting detail because Brian insisted his truck had been running perfectly before this. So naturally, he got out, decided to try to figure out what was going on. And that's when he noticed movement. Something was descending from the trees, or maybe just from the air itself. He later estimated that it landed only about 30 feet away. So think about that. 30 feet, okay? To give you some perspective, 30 feet is roughly 10 yards, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If there's 3 feet in a yard, imagine you're standing on the goal line of a football field and this thing is on the 10-yard line.
Yeah.
Okay? That's close.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, that is close.
I can throw a football that far.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I could probably spit at it and hit it.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
But, I mean, it's close, okay? I can't describe it any better. It's close. It's close enough to see tons of detail. We don't get Bigfoot sightings that are that close. I mean, not typically.
Yeah, right.
Brian later described the creature as standing roughly 9 feet tall. Its body was covered in blue fur, and its eyes were bright yellow. Its ears came to points, and its mouth revealed rows of sharp white teeth, and folded behind it were enormous wings. Now, here's another interesting detail. Brian never claimed that the creature charged him. He said it never screamed, it didn't attack his truck. Instead, it stood there, watching him, which is creepy.
That's just as bad.
Yeah, because that makes me think it's trying to decide if I'm worth eating.
Mm-hmm.
Brian later said he didn't actually feel like the creature wanted to hurt him. No, it wanted to eat him.
Yeah, he said, make it quick. It wouldn't hurt.
He said it just felt out of place. Well, yeah, a giant bat. That's out of place anywhere.
With a monkey wolf face.
Yeah. You know what I would have been afraid of if I was Brian Canfield?
The whole thing?
Yeah, but I would have thought, how big is the vampire that this thing is going to turn into? It's going to be like a 30-foot tall Count Dracula, you know, with the collar and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Blah.
Yeah. I mean, just massive. Okay, so just imagine that you're Brian standing there. I mean, it's totally silent. You're making eye contact with something that shouldn't exist, and neither one of you are moving. But then, according to Brian, the creature slowly opened its wings, and when he said wings, he meant enormous wings.
Yeah.
He said he estimated that they stretched about 50 feet across. I mean,
honestly, I would rather that than it stretch out its wings and they're like 2 inches on either side and you got these little, you know.
He flies like a bumblebee.
Yeah, know? Exactly. That's what I was picturing, little bee wings on it. Everywhere.
But the estimate has always been controversial. That has been controversial. Out of this whole story, well, the 50 feet wing, it could never have 50 foot wingspan.
Yeah.
We're talking about a 9 foot bat. And you're worried about how big the wings are? Okay.
You and I have been on cryptid and UFO and paranormal social media for long enough that we know that would absolutely be the case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You'd have somebody telling a story and they go, well, actually, those wings are impossible for anything. And if they were actually going to hold it up, it would need to be 70 feet across. Right. And you can't have that because of aerodynamics. And you're like, yeah, that's it. Okay. Thanks.
But you're exactly right, by the way. But think about this. A 50 foot wingspan would be larger than a small airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's huge. Someone could misjudge the size of those wings if they're standing there staring at this thing 30 feet away.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, you don't know how long he saw it with these wings folded out.
Yeah.
All he knew is that it was bigger than what he would have expected. Mm-hmm. But he's sitting there going, I didn't expect to see a giant bat either.
Right. Exactly. First, I thought this was a blue Bigfoot. Now it's got wings. What's going on?
But it you'll notice it's common in the eyewitness reports, you know, that talking about these giant wings. But whatever Brian saw, he was convinced it was enormous. And he said the creature launched itself upward. Brian described the force of those wing beats as actually rocking the truck. Yeah. Then it disappeared. Now, here's the part that paranormal researchers love. The moment the creature was gone, his truck started up just immediately. Huh. No repairs. He didn't have a jump start, nothing. He just turned the key and it fired right up. And again, there could be a perfectly ordinary explanation. I mean,
probably not.
Well, yeah. You know, you think about it though. Intermittent electrical failures happen.
Yeah.
I personally have never been in a vehicle that just completely shut off and it just started right up.
No.
Minutes later. I've never seen that happen. I mean, if all the lights go off on your dash, your engine stops and it's not doing anything, something is way wrong, and it's not just going to fix itself.
Yeah. But anytime that's happened to me, it's taken thousands of dollars and many days to get fixed.
And a tow and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Brian said nothing of that happened. He got back in his truck and it started up.
Jeez. Okay.
But it's another one of those details that people keep talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian went home and immediately drew what he had seen. The sketch would eventually become the basis for almost every modern illustration for the Bat Squatch. What's interesting is that Brian didn't wait 20 years. He didn't suddenly decide to tell the story after cryptids got popular online. He documented it almost immediately. And eventually his story reached reporter C.R. Roberts of the Tacoma News Tribune. Now, Roberts is the one that coined the name Bat Squatch. So we have C.R. Roberts to thank for this, you know, amazing name.
Couldn't have come up with something better.
I'm telling you.
Roberts.
It was a Sasquatch that looked like a bat. Yeah. So it was a
perfect
Bat Squatch.
Name. Let's call it Bat Squatch.
You're what else are they going to call it, though? Robert? Like Fred?
I mean, Timmy the Terrible.
Craig.
Yeah.
That's what Amanda would call it. Amanda has this thing about naming stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she names it like mundane people names or something like that. It's why all of our dogs have had like regular people names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of our pets, any pet, the fish, the lizard, they all had just regular
names. I prefer a regular old boring name for a dog.
Yeah.
Like that. We got Henry, Nash, and we had Dallas. Those could all be human dude names.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
My mother, however, goes crazy with weird dog names. And I'm like, I can't remember Floofy Doodle Poodle Butt. I can't remember that.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I'll go to a patient's house and they'll have some crazy big dog. And I'm like, what's your dog's name? That's Xerxes. I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, do you call Xerxes out the back door, you know, come here, Xerxes. Like, shut up.
Xerxes, are you done crapping yet? Get in this house, Xerxes.
This dog's name is Philip.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Then people don't know whether you're yelling at your kid to quit crapping on your porch or the dog. It's great.
Did you ever watch Magnum P.I.? The original? Yeah, you can probably call it reruns of it. I was trying to remember, you know, Magnum lives on the estate that's owned by Robin Masters, that you had never seen. You know, Higgins is there, and there's two Dobermans. And I think one of them was named Apollo, and I think the other one was Zeus. It was Zeus and Apollo, and they were Dobermans. I always thought, now that's cool. If I ever had a Doberman, I would name it like Apollo. That's the
like
only time
kind of
I would venture out of the regular name for a dog.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a Doberman, you know, in tribute to Magnum, I would be like, you're Apollo. I think that's pretty cool. But anyway, I digress. But the article that C.R. Roberts wrote about Bat Squatch, it spread like wildfire. Cryptid enthusiasts picked it up, books repeated it, television shows covered it, and suddenly Washington had its own flying monster.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where things get a little frustrating. After Brian's report became public, people started remembering similar experiences.
Yeah.
Not having new ones, remembering old ones. Or at least they claimed they did. Now, one of the most frequently repeated stories involves a pilot named Butch Whitaker. According to later retellings, he was flying over the Cascade Mountains when he encountered an enormous winged creature. Unfortunately, finding the original source for that story is incredibly difficult. Most websites simply quote one another, which is always a red flag. Okay. Yeah. If you're doing any kind of research and you find information on a website and then you search it and you find another website that quotes the website you were just on, you need to be a little skeptical. Okay. Cause you're fixing to find that the next seven websites will all quote one another and you're like, is this even real?
And the wording of the story doesn't change much.
Right. It's like, usually verbatim or very close.
Yep. Yep.
So pretty much everybody is just citing everybody else. Okay. We're in a big crowd and we've all come to an agreement that this is the story we're telling. I mean, it's the equivalent.
Yeah.
But eventually no one remembers where the information actually came from. So while the story exists, treat it carefully. Now, another report comes from 1998. I mean, you got to understand, these are pretty recent. I mean, you know, in the last 30 years, I mean, people are going, we saw this thing.
They weren't that long after the eruption either.
No. I mean, within 20 years after the eruption and within the last 30 years. So Bat Squatch really only has about, you know, a 50 to 60 year history.
Mm-hmm.
But a logging truck driver supposedly struck a massive winged animal while driving through Oregon. Again, the descriptions vary depending on who's telling the story. Some versions say the creature had purple facial features. Say that five times fast.
No thanks.
But others don't. Some say it flew away. Others imply that it disappeared. No body was recovered. No feathers, no fur, no blood, nothing. Then there are occasional reports from hikers around Mount St. Helens and even in Mount Shasta, which has got its own set of weird stuff.
Yeah.
People describe seeing enormous shadows, something gliding overhead, large winged humanoids emerging from fog. But once again, almost all of these stories surfaced years after the original Canfield encounter. And none include physical evidence. No photographs, no tracks, no DNA, nothing that could actually be studied. So where does that leave us, really? If you're looking for hard evidence, this case is incredibly weak.
Yep.
There's never been a body, never a feather, never a hair sample, not even a clear photograph, not even a footprint. And unlike Bigfoot, there isn't a long historical tradition describing this exact creature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why skeptics remain unconvinced. But here's what I think makes this story interesting. Brian Canfield has never become famous. Okay? He did not write a best-selling book. He never started charging money for appearances. He didn't build a career around seeing the Bat Squatch. As far as anyone can tell, he just simply reported what he believed he had seen. Now, again, that's not proof, but it does remove one common motivation people often point to. So, what could the Bat Squatch actually be? Well, the most obvious explanation is simple misidentification. A large bird. An owl. It's not an owl.
It's always an owl.
Some say an eagle. Perhaps if you saw it under unusual lighting. The problem is none of these animals are anywhere close to 9 feet tall.
No.
I mean, even the biggest of them are not that big. None of them have blue fur, and none look even remotely humanoid. So some people have suggested that giant fruit bats that somehow escaped captivity are to blame. But even that explanation falls apart pretty quickly. Flying foxes, which is what I thought of when I read the description of bat squatches. Flying foxes can have wingspans that approach about 6 feet. Okay? That's impressive.
Yeah.
20 feet? And it's not even close. Now, others suggested stress or fear or memory distortion. I mean, our brains are really good at filling in the missing information during a shocking event.
Sure.
And, you know, that's well documented. But then, of course, there's a possibility that Brian really did see something unknown, not necessarily supernatural, not mm-hmm. necessarily a monster, just something science hasn't documented. History has plenty of examples of animals once considered mythical before they were finally discovered. Like the giant squid.
That's true, yeah.
Or the mountain gorilla. The okapi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but none of these comparisons actually prove that the bat squatch exists, okay? But they remind us that nature can still surprise us. Now, personally, I have no idea what Brian Canfield saw. I don't think there's enough evidence to confidently say that there is or ever was a giant flying primate hiding in the forest of Washington. But I also can't completely dismiss every witness as either lying or hallucinating either.
That's true.
I think something happened to Brian that morning. Whether it was an unknown animal, a mistaken identification, or something way weirder, we'll probably never know, and maybe that's why this story has endured, is not because there's 100 sightings, but because there aren't. Because unlike mm-hmm. many cryptids, the Bat Squatch remains elusive. A mystery built on one unforgettable encounter, and a handful of scattered reports, and a single question that still hangs over the forest of the Pacific Northwest. What, if anything, did Brian Canfield actually see? And if he really did see something, could it still be out there? I mean, what do you think, Adam? I mean, it is a unique story in and of itself. It doesn't really fit the mold of the typical cryptid encounters that we've talked about on this show before.
Right.
Like I said, there aren't a ton of reports. I mean, there is one, and then there's just a smattering of a few others that are probably even less credible than Brian Canfield.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think possibly happened?
If we're to take Brian as he saw what he saw, that it wasn't a mistaken identity, whatever. What he described is what he actually saw. The truck stopping makes me, like a lot of other of the investigators and stuff that have talked about it, go to UFO.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, I said the crazy explanation that I've got that doesn't even make sense to me, but I'm going to say it anyway. We see the volcano in Mexico, Popocatépetl or something mm-hmm. like that. We did an episode on it, forgot how to pronounce it. We see UFOs there all the time. Mm-hmm. So what if a UFO was in the vicinity of this volcano and that is what it's like Chupacabra. Everybody says it was dropped off from a UFO. Well, could Bat Squatch be something like that, where it's a creature from a UFO?
That's kind of where I lean. And I'll tell you why. I think if this was something that was undiscovered, okay, if there's an actual living animal, a species of giant bat, okay, mm-hmm. I think that there would be more sightings. I mean, hundreds, but I think that there would be more, especially in the 90s, as nature kind of started coming back to the area around Mount St. Helens, as people came back to that. hunters, geologists that are studying the soil and everything, people that were out there, loggers getting back to work, somebody would have run across something, you know, a dead one, you know, more evidence than what we have.
Right, right.
So, again, keeping a wide open mind, I would say that based on the experience that he describes, that this would have been something more or less extraterrestrial, not an undiscovered species.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
If you want to take it a step further, you could say, what if it was interdimensional? You know, what if this was, you know, a creature that managed to cross over somehow, you know, in an area where, you know, geological havoc occurred.
Yeah.
You know, right. I mean, here's the thing. Yeah, nature started coming back fairly quickly after that. But, I mean, volcanic soil is rich. I mean, that is not, you know, unfavorable to foliage growth. I mean, volcanic soil usually does really well. So at some point, you know, there's going to be more changes than just to the physical features. Does that make sense? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, the energy field around that area was disrupted in a massive way. I mean,
for sure.
You know, we talk about volcanoes. It's what makes up that magma is it's got to be more than just rock. Okay. There's all kinds of metals and things in there that are in the earth that melt right along with the rock. Okay.
Geologists say all the time that one of the explanations for UFOs around it is volcanic lights.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
the explosion, the eruption of the volcano actually creates a light phenomena in the atmosphere. So if it's going to do that, there is the potential of it tearing open some type of wormhole that we've discussed before.
Why not? I mean, all bets are off here. But you think about, I mean, like, I think iron, you know, especially, you know, would be mixed in there, and now it's spread all over the place, okay, along with other metals that are going to alter, you know, magnetic fields in that area. They're going to alter how electrical equipment operates in that area. So if that stuff is going to go on, wouldn't you think, again, with a very open mind, that this could be a scenario that would allow something like that to cross over? Maybe it was there after the eruption and nobody saw it because people were gone for a period of time. And as people started coming back, you know, Brian just happened to be the lucky individual that ran across it along with a few others that saw something. You know, the people that reported seeing shadows, you're working out there, you're a logger, you're a hiker, whatever, you're hunting, and all of a sudden a big shadow goes right over you. Well, guess what? A big bird flying above you can cast a really weird large shadow on the ground, and you see it quickly enough that you go, whoa, and you look up, and by the time you look up, whatever it was is gone.
Yep.
You know, so that's not evidence to me. That's just people, you know, flipping out. But, I mean, you know, what Brian Canfield saw was uniquely specific. And I just, you can go read his story yourself. You can go read the article that C.R. Roberts wrote and judge for yourself. I mean, he had an experience. Now,
he experienced something.
If he was going to hallucinate something like that, you know, driving down the road, I mean, he's he must have been playing with some pharmaceuticals, because I'll tell you this, I don't think that's what I would hallucinate.
No. And if you were playing with the pharmaceuticals, you wouldn't have told anybody.
True.
Like, yeah, you wouldn't have gone to
you would have
newspaper.
Gone home and said, God, that was weird, and done like the old the cartoons where they go home and they dump out the liquor bottles, you know? It's like, I'm done.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. This is weird. I mean, that's what you would have done. That's what I would have done. But he didn't. And he immediately reported it. So I think he had some weird experience. I don't know what exactly it was. But like I said, if you keep an open mind, you can imagine a scenario where something like this might exist up there. You know, or it was at least existed long enough to be seen, you know, at least once. So, but what do you guys think? Have you even heard of Bat Squatch? You know, you may have come across it and been like, be like Adam, what is this? Somebody made this up. You know, well, this is dumb. What the? And you didn't even look into it to think, man, there was really a dude that saw what has been termed a Bat Squatch.
Right.
Let us know. And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. We got people talking about all kinds of stuff in there all the time. It's really a cool place. You know, you can come in there and share stories. You can read other people's experiences, you know, share some jokes and things like that. It's really cool. Nobody's going to call you crazy or anything like that. We just all love hearing these stories. Don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. There you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show, and that is where you can become a patron. And thank you so much to everyone who has donated to the work that Adam and I have done over the years. We sincerely appreciate it. As independent podcasters, we rely on that to keep our show going and putting it out there. So thank you for that. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Oh my gosh, you can't be serious. You think making the pick is the hard part? No, it's not. The pick takes like 3 seconds. You know what's hard? The sweat. The time between locking in and cashing out. Yeah, you have a take, but in the end, it's not about the winners or losers. This is about us, man. Whether we're brave enough to sit through it. Don't fight the sweat. Live in it. Because you are an underdog. Underdog. Unleash your dog.
Terms may apply.
There's a fire inside you you can't ignore. Stand still, not a chance. You're a lifelong learner who's come this far. Now, we're here to help you keep going further. Capella University, what can't you do? Visit capella.edu to learn more.